This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there. Okay, so that was a rebroadcast of the evening news, and now it's time for the Marsh Orthodox Radio Crusade, as you just heard. And, well, I just wanted to say before we go to our opening music that if you are offended by strong language, this would be a good opportunity for you to turn off your radio. And, in fact, if you dislike really bad music, this would also be an opportunity for you to turn off the radio, because what you're about to hear borders on the unlistenable, as a matter of fact. And we're playing it purely for historically didactic purposes, so you're really going to hate it unless you're a masochistic 1980s nostalgist like us here in the studio tonight. So, with that, you've been duly warned. right, let's give this soothing, restful, new age music a break here. Okay, well, how many of you people out there are astute enough to recognize that? Welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM, with four people who are all veterans of the August 6th, 1988 Tompkins Square riot, including me, Bill Weinberg, your host, and Chris Flash, who is the editor of the Lower East Side's longtime underground rag, The Shadow. Welcome aboard, Chris.
Howdy, howdy.
And Frank Morales, another longtime Lower East Side activist and editor of the Police State America anthology. Is that a hat that you choose to wear tonight, Frank?
Editor, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, okay. And Mary Sol Ruiz, who I just found out tonight, was also there at Tompkins Square on that fateful night of August 6th and is a veteran Lower East Side squatter.
Buenos días a todos.
Buenas noches. Para los bujos.
Well, it's after midnight, so technically speaking, Diaz is correct.
So, did you remember that, you remember those sounds that they opened up with there? They were immediately recognizable for all of us who were there on that hot night. And those sounds were being sampled by a shadowy organization, as it was referred to in the New York Times, called the Missing Foundation.
Weren't they known as the Cult of Rage, or referred to as Cult of Rage?
That was Mike Taibbi, or was it Matt Taibbi?
Mike Taibbi.
Mike Taibbi, the younger, or the older. That'd be the older.
I didn't know there was a second one.
The other one is his son. Right. Right, exactly. So, are we resurrecting Missing Foundation for the upcoming 20th anniversary bash of the Tompkins Square riot?
Well, we did try to get in touch with – actually, we did successfully reach Pete Missing, the head guy from Missing Foundation. Unfortunately, he's occupied in Europe doing different things, and he couldn't make it. So we're having what I think is a pretty darn good show composed of riot veterans, vintage 80s punk bands including Hammerbrain, Reagan Youth, Nihilistics, False Prophets, Apple, Kraut, and – two other acts that are less punkish but were nevertheless extremely relevant and there in those days, including David Peel, the infamous David Peel, Up Against the Wall MF, and Professor Louie. And most people from those days remember Professor Louie very well.
Definitely. I'm glad to hear Professor Louie's still around. I played some of his music just recently, and I was wondering, whatever happened to Professor Louie?
He's traveling around the country, outside of the U.S. He's famous everywhere. It's amazing. Oh. And he's still doing his thing, still going strong.
We did a gig with him about a month ago at the community church. He was there for an event there.
Mm-hmm. The community church being?
Up on Park Avenue there. It's a venue for political activists.
So, yeah, that show is taking place. This punk show I've just described is taking place on this coming Sunday, on July 27th, from 1 to 7 p.m. in Tompkins Square Park at the site of the old band shell, which we're hoping will successfully get rebuilt through a campaign.
We'll be lucky to keep the surveillance cameras out of Tompkins Square Park, if you ask me, let alone rebuilding the band shell.
Well, you know, they're saying a journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step.
Yes,
so,
yes.
You know, and you usually get what you want when you project it and put enough, you know, force behind it.
Yes. Or, well, the more, even if you don't get what you want, you know, the more ambitious your demands, the more you're going to get, even if it falls short of, you know, your most ambitious demands.
Right on. There you go. And then the following weekend are two more shows in Tompkins Square Park, the following Saturday, August 2nd and August 3rd, which also commemorate the August 6th 20th anniversary of Tompkins Square Park. Right?
Wow, so three weekends in a row.
Yeah, pretty ambitious. Mm. But all this great energy there, all these extra new people that have been in the scene for the past few years.
All right, so all those bands which you mentioned, they were all bands which played in the Tompkins Square band shell back in the day in the 1980s.
Yes, and some of them, unfortunately, or for better or worse, were either directly in the riot or peripherally in the riot, and some of them actually got beaten up by cops during the riot. The lead singer for Hammerbrain, Al, the nicest guy in the world, got horribly beaten by the police. I took photographs and bloody mouth and welts on his back, his bare back, in the shape of nightsticks. They were riding past him on horseback, and they just whacked him like they were playing polo. and he had these huge, long, hot dog-shaped red marks on his back. And he actually, Allen Ginsberg actually came to his rescue, put his arm around him, kind of like led him away really quick before the cops could finish the job. So that was an interesting
moment. Wow, right on Allen.
Dave from Reagan Youth, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, got hit in the head by the police. He got stitches. He got, I think everyone that got hit by the cops got like a $50,000 settlement each.
Well,
so
a lot of people did. One man had his skull cracked on First Avenue. Fish, I think his name was. Ginsberg's friend was from Kansas.
Right, but that's not the guy who was who you saw being.
No, that was Al from Hammerbane.
Right, exactly.
You know, I'm not going to mention where he works, but strangely, ironically enough, Ray Kelly seems to enjoy going to his restaurant. Police Commissioner Ray Kelly likes going to the restaurant where Al works. So it's an interesting full circle there.
Mm.
Well, Al holds no grudges, you know, but you know they got him. They Reagan Youth, members of Public Nuisance, Lech Patrol. All these punk bands, members of punk bands, a lot of them got beaten up by the police that night. It's very odd. So
Dave Insurgent was the lead singer from Reagan Youth.
Yeah, a good friend of mine, unfortunately passed away under very bad circumstances.
He's not going to be there.
In spirit, yes, Bill.
He'll be there in spirit. There you go.
But the band is still, you know, going strong. So thank
really?
Goodness.
No kidding. Yeah. Reagan Youth is still happening.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing that all these guys are still around and still performing and still...
And they haven't changed their name. They're still Reagan Youth.
No, but all these bands are politically committed to what we're about, and they're still performing.
Young.
Still vital, yeah. You know, it's amazing. Revolutionary zeal keeps you young and vital, I guess.
Clean living.
That too.
So what about the False Prophets?
They're still around. You know Steve Wishnia?
Yeah, he was here last weekend.
Yeah, he's
last Tuesday.
He plays in various bands, and he's happening.
So when are they playing in Tompkins Square?
This Sunday.
This Sunday.
So yeah, I'll just name the bands again if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
If it's okay with you.
Go ahead, yeah.
We got Hammerbrain, and these are all, you know, 80s punk bands that were there in the day, and they're still around. And some of them are not so active, but they're kind of coming together for the show as well. Hammerbrain, Reagan Youth, Nihilistics, False Prophets, Apple, David Peel, Professor Louie, and Kraut. And I think we're going to have Bobby Steele from the Undead do an acoustic set.
Mm.
So that should be all very interesting.
Okay, now, for people who are not 1980s nostalgists and weren't around back then, what the hell are we talking about? What the hell was the Tompkins Square riot? What the hell was the Tompkins Square band shell? You mean there used to be a band shell in Tompkins Square Park? Really?
Maybe Frank could tell the story better than I.
Ever since, you know, when I was a kid, the park...
Now you grew up in the hood.
I grew up on Avenue D, yeah. So, but on occasion, we'd make it over to Tompkins. We hung out there. As I got older, we hung out there a lot. And the band shell, it was always open 24 hours. The park was always 24/7. And the band shell was a place that people could play, but also it had electric. And more often than not, the electric was live. So you could just come set up. So you can imagine through the 60s and so on, bands and concert shows and all-night stuff. That's the way it always was. And in the 80s, it was used for that, 85, 86, 87, 88. But also it was a base of, which it had been historically, a base organization of opposing people who opposed various agendas, the housing agendas and the treatment of homeless people. It was a squatter campaign at that point. People were taking over buildings. We were in like 30, 40 buildings.
But how did the band shell come to be built and put together? Because
it hadn't
existed before 67.
No,
they built it in 67 as a way to...
Right.
I mean, you know, you were there when that happened.
No, it was probably built out of the spirit of the times. People were into having, bands outside. You know, it's like, and they built a band shell.
My understanding is the public demanded it. People, like, the more, let's say, active members of the community demanded a venue by which, and it wasn't just...
Because it was civilized.
It wasn't
people
just
had
Latinos
values,
and hippies. It was also Ukrainians. I mean, they had their shows there. Everyone, it was a multicultural venue. Available for the community, like Frank said.
Unbelievable.
They could just plug in and play. And that was, and you had some fantastic concert. You had Grateful Dead.
You'd see Salsa there. You'd see the Dead there.
The Fugs.
Like the Fugs there.
Jefferson Airplane. And I got some of the recordings of them.
But it's powerful because when you have a place like that, people can get together and feel really good, but also organize to power in the neighborhood and beyond. That's dangerous. So they attacked the terrain. So basically, one day in July of 1988, summer, park's open 24/7. across each of the entrances was painted, scrawled in this sort of sloppy paint, yellow paint, "Park closes at midnight." And nobody knew who did it. Everybody's going, "What the hell is this?" The community board.
Well, it actually was 1 o'clock then, right? Wasn't it? Originally, they tried to put a 1 o'clock.
Yeah, no, but the paint said, "Park closes at midnight."
No, the
some anonymous
said,
person painted them in yellow letters.
Oh, yeah, they were painted in front of all the entrances, said, "Park closes at midnight." And we're all going, like, who says? What the hell is this all about?
This wasn't codified. It wasn't a regulation. It wasn't agreed upon. There was no public hearing. It's just some...
No, well, the community board in June, this is August, and the community board doesn't meet in the summer. Their last meeting was taken up. The issue was pushed by the right-wing elements in the community board. It was voted 28-0 down. Nobody wanted it. What happened is Manhattan South had a meeting...
Please clarify, Manhattan South Task Force, the police.
Manhattan South Task Force. This
the
is
police
an extra,
department.
The whole thing about Tompkins Square Park, politically and in some ways, it was an extra legal operation. It was a signal of the era of extra legal police operations. In other words, outside the law. This was not sanctioned by anyone other than these police elements that got together, obviously with mayoral people and other people that were at this meeting. We have the minutes of the meeting. We have the whole thing. They were passing flyers around that we had put out and yucking it up at some of our graphics, you know, stuff like that. And they decided that they were going to try to enforce a curfew against the will of the community board and the people in the neighborhood.
But to do that, they had to get a couple of shills. They had this Tompkins Square, this secret meeting where they had members of the community they believed were sympathetic to this idea, and to basically get some kind of pseudo-official request, please, police, can you enforce this curfew in the park? And some of the more, let's say, well-connected investigative journalists in our neighborhood discovered that this meeting had taken place, the list of people who attended the meeting.
A year before, in 87, Mayor Koch and Parks Commissioner Henry Stern had gotten together, and they put a panel together, which was headed up by Cyrus Vance. Now, this is a Manhattan panel that was put together
former
by Koch.
Former Secretary of State?
Former Secretary of State, and I think Defense. He was the infamous author of the Black Book, which is a kind of what Warren Christopher did for the L.A. riots, quote-unquote. Vance did for the Detroit riots. It was basically an urban primer on civil disorder management and so forth. And so anyway, this is Vance. Vance is tasked by Mayor Koch to head up a blue ribbon panel on the parks and the Constitution in 1987 here in New York. And they put forward that, you know, there were various questions, constitutional questions that arising out of First Amendment rights in public space and so forth and so on. But essentially what it argues is that these could be overcome. They began to see that terrain that was open and public with people who were creative and want to organize
politically active
and collaborate and so forth was the danger. So all the terrain in the Lower East Side and other places became contested. It was already contested because homeless people and low-income people and so forth were already facing this barrage, this assault on their housing in terms of displacement. So, you know, this is all in that context. There's a literal kind of a war against the poor in the urban centers. And so this was one aspect of it. The idea, particularly on the Lower East Side with a diverse community, you know, street people and poets and you know, soccer moms. I guess there are not too many soccer moms, but you know what I mean. A very diverse population getting together. The public space in Tompkins Square Park became a threat. So the curfew, they try to enforce this curfew top-down, kind of like class struggle from above, so to speak, and try to enforce it. And we gathered there.
Well, what happened was, if you don't mind, sorry.
No, I'm just saying that's kind of the definition of this particular weekend.
But on July 31st, a week before the big riot, there was like a mini skirmish with the police. There was a bunch of just maybe a few dozen people kind of chilling out, not near the bench hall so much, but more like near the Hare Krishna tree, you know, where the park benches are. And
it's just right in front of where the bench hall was.
Yeah, but, you know, not at the bench, like where the benches are, where the hippie hill is, And they, you know, some people strumming guitar, other people just talking and chatting, and the cops just came in with really, without reading any warning, without giving anyone any chance to disperse, they just came in and started basically insisting everyone get out right now. They started swinging their clubs as they were saying it. So that night, and this is my recollection because I was there that night.
And this happened around midnight?
About midnight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And basically they chased everybody out of the park, and they succeeded in getting people out of the park because nobody was expecting this assault on them suddenly, a sudden massive assault. And people left the park, and, you know, I heard like, you know, like people getting their heads hit with clubs. It was really insane. I couldn't believe my eyes. I was running away. And over the next 7 days, people in the community decided that they were going to respond on the following weekend. They weren't not going to let the park be closed at midnight on the following weekend. And the police decided to respond in kind by building up their defenses for the following weekend and putting on a huge show of force. They had police maneuvers on foot, on horseback. They had command posts set up. They had police cars surrounding the block. It was like the scene from West Side Story where the Sharks and the Jets are building up their numbers to prepare for the big rumble under the elevated West Side Highway. And it was like that insane. And, well, I don't know. Should I get into...
Please, if you feel inspired, I can tell you're kind of on a roll.
Yeah, let me read you a little bit from...
Your memoir. Frank Morales brought his memoirs.
Personal...
This is because my memory is so bad. My flyer, calling out people to rally to resist the curfew, exclaimed that the park belongs to the people and hands off the homeless. It had cool little tree graphics that Chloe, the beautiful actress from Bad Lieutenant, and her boyfriend had given me. In large old script, it said, "It is clear that those who seek to push us out of the park aim to further gentrify our neighborhood and will stop at nothing to protect their profits, including using the police against the people." Determined, I stated that we will no longer allow an unrepresentative minority of yuppie developers to dictate to the majority when and under what conditions we can use our park. I ran off about 50 copies, posted them along Avenue A with Kenny at my back watching for the man. In those days, you could do 3 days in the clink for putting out the word. Apparently, you still can. It was getting dark, the 5th of August, Friday night. Don Houston, frail, hippie geezer, well-weathered folk singer with a happy twinkle in his raggediness and a wise gleam in his eye, was belting out in his own beloved, crackling, inebriated style, squatter lyrics to the tune of La Bamba. "Break the walls down, baby!" Standing in the park, hobnobbing with the chess players along 7th Street, I wondered what was going to happen the next day. Knew something was coming, was glad it could wait one more day. Pat Storm assured me that the shit was indeed about to hit the fan. He usually was on about those things. Nonetheless, the mood was festive, peaceful, loads of locals and weekenders grooving in the early Friday evening twilight. Suddenly the cops roll in, again unannounced, only this time with massive amounts of equipment, driving right up into the park with 20 van loads, taking over the Bamshell area, very businesslike. People start drifting away, realize this is no movie set, but the real thing. The cops proceed to stuff the area, the heart of Tompkins Park, with numerous emergency service vehicles, squad cars, FEMA communications, command center, techno stuff, and blue buses to presumably lock us up in. A real show of force. It was clear the preemptive assemblage of materiel signaled to even the most blasé that the cops meant business. Canceling our event was the least of it. They were getting ready to rumble, and they wanted us to know it. We knew what time it was. I'll read just one more paragraph here. A local, S. Gustav Haglund, present on the scene, composed some appropriate, quote, notes during wartime. He put it this way. Tompkins Square Park, display of force, the night before demonstration, 30 police vans from all precincts, 5 burly cops in every entrance exit. Park is completely surrounded, jackbooted stormtroopers on horseback, the whole area from Banshell to benches, thick with police, nervous, anxious, threatening, miming out baseball bat swings of anticipated violent assault, floodlights cutting across the night sky, police state naked, ugly. Trust me, he told it like it was. Saturday, August 6th, 1988, I hadn't slept, felt like I was sleepwalking down East 10th Street along the park, surveying with some trepidation our very own Terra Dome in the hot mid-afternoon sun, when two undercovers slide up to me, greasy lizard style, like they know me. One guy about 30, beet red, freckled-faced lifeguard type, and his buddy, de rigueur, white sneaks and beer-bellied blue jeans, inquire, "You ever sleep?" To which I respond, never. You know all, we know all about you, they sneer. So what, I said. One guy tries to get up close and personal, shoving me up against the fence. No one likes being shoved. I'm about ready to start shoving back, casting all discretion out the window, when Father Kuhn, righteous pastor at St. Bridget's, happens by, waving hello. The Flatfoots, who could have been choir boys once, decide to move on, hiding under some rock. Anyway, it keeps going.
Well, that's beautiful, man. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I take with me from that time, and I think that is important for people to see now, is that people can resist, that it's not only a moral requirement, but it's a practical thing, and that people have just not, you know, need to see the when the people get together and push back. Because, yeah, people took a lot of blows. But I remember, too, you know, pushing these people back, getting the point across to people that unless they seized control of the abandoned buildings, fought the displacement, that they were going to be priced out of this neighborhood. I don't think anybody argues that, you know, what we had to say at that point was on point.
Well, we should also really be clear, it was more than just like a repeat of a scene from West Side Story. It was also the other issues. There were underlying issues at that time in 88. The first wave of major gentrification was pretty much hitting its peak in the neighborhood. Rents were going pretty high from, let's say, $100 or $200 a month for a studio to an unheard of $700 a month. And now it's more like $1,700 a month. But at the time, you know, major changes were taking place in the cost of living. There was definitely an effort by the city to change the demographics of the Lower East Side by using police to enforce that and to facilitate it. You had landlords buying and flipping buildings like crazy. They were torching buildings. The city seemed to declare war on squatters who were taking over city-owned abandoned buildings and fixed them at their own expense, not at the public expense, unlike other housing groups, so-called housing groups. But there are a lot of underlying issues, everything from this disparity between the ultra-rich and the lower-income people in the neighborhood to high levels of gentrification, more yuppie businesses pushing out mom-and-pops that have been there for 20 years. Kind of what's happening right now.
That's the thing. It's what is happening. It's the continuum. Now we've got recently the case with the mansion. The guy wants to make a mansion and push all these people out of the building.
On East 3rd Street. This is the latest wave of the same.
And look at the foreclosure thing all around the country. The right to a home, right, is a human right. And the thing is that unless we overcome the system of speculation.
All right, before we get up to the current moment, because we're kind of like, you know, we were back in 1988 in 1 minute, and like now all of a sudden it's 20 years later.
Well, the thing is, it's all relevant. It's
20 years.
It's all relevant.
I should say that it's 12:30 in the morning on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. We're in the house with Chris Flash, who is the editor of the Lower East Side's longtime underground newspaper, The Shadow.
And I like the word newspaper better than rag. Thank you.
Yeah, I meant it in a, you know, a
I'm sure.
cordial
I'm
sense.
I'm just kidding.
The Reverend Frank Morales, who is co-editor of the anthology Police State America, and a longtime activist fixture in the neighborhood, and Mary Sol Ruiz, who must have gone out to take a powder, but we definitely want to hear her reminiscences about that hot, muggy night of August 6, 1988 as well. But before, you know, we talk about the present predicament, finish the story. Because, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't know that there was ever a Tompkins Square band shell. What happened to it? All right? So
okay,
1988 was kind of the beginning of the resistance movement.
Well,
what happened after that?
I would say 88 was the culmination of years of resistance and finally, let's say, the straw that broke the camel's back, hot summer night, police repression, a lot of factors
Started taking buildings on the Lower East Side in 84, 85. There were people in the vacant lots building housing in the vacant lots that I recall, but you know so there was 2-3 years,
right? Okay, but it sort of jumped into a whole different level following.
Well, actually, Bill, from the way I
August
look at
1988.
It, after 88, we had this confrontation with the police around the curfew, which Koch withdrew, by the way. The following Monday, they backed off for a while
as a result of the negative publicity.
Then, really, from my perspective, the repression really was ratcheted up. in terms of the desire on the part to deal with this, from whether they call it a squatter issue or the issue of the Lower East Side, you know, that these activists who are actually taking matters into their own hands. In other words, intervening into the social processes on the Lower East Side to the extent that was becoming dangerous. They were taking land, they're taking space, land, housing. You know, that tends to fool with most people's agendas, even like a lot of progressive people's agendas when it's like real. And so, you know, that the reaction begins comes in where there are attacks on 8th Street of 319, various SWAT moves on a number of the buildings in the course of the, you know, just the year up to the riot, so-called riot, and then right through 89.
Or the police riot, I believe is the preferred term.
And don't forget, by 89 and then going into 90, the homeless people in the park are attacked.
Right, the homeless people who set up what they call the Dinkinsville,
a
Hooverville, named after the city's then mayor, in Tompkins Square.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this whole process, so the way I look at it, right immediately following the August 88, there was a period of recalibrating the tactics, techniques, and procedures, as the Pentagon likes to put it, of repression. And the suppression of dissent, and you know, what are we going to do about these open spaces? Studies, Cyrus Vance, and all these different kinds of the science of counterinsurgency, if you will.
All right. So how you was know. This actually applied?
Well, like I said, through SWAT and direct action eviction attempts on the squatter building.
Right.
Through the forcible eviction of homeless people from the park in which they burned down the entire homeless camp. This is by 89 and 90 now.
So over the course of the next, about 2.5-3 years, there were several more.
Yeah, it's a counterinsurgency that's ongoing, the shelters.
Several more actual physical conflicts around the park.
There were regular skirmishes between neighborhood activists and the police.
Right.
Practically every other weekend was something.
And more broadly, too, because it was also the question of the homeless people. And what was happening was that the shelters, which, you know, were places where people were going to get a place to live, were becoming more like low-intensity detention centers. They didn't always have video cameras when you walked in. There was more flexibility. The repression of street people and homeless people, the attack on the poor at the base, the housing, along with the other kinds of things we've come to know are part of displacement, arson for profit, real estate scams, redlining, disinvestment of the banks, so on and so forth.
In terms of what
that's
Bill,
the context of what's going on.
Right.
To address what Bill is specifically getting at, though, there were concerted efforts on the part of police to provoke certain responses from people in the neighborhood. We were unfortunately foolish enough to play into their hands on many occasions where if the police started a riot or started a provocation, many people would respond with, let's say, equal aggressive action, and the police, of course, would take that to the next level as their excuse to increase their aggressiveness. And so we had a few riots after the 88 riot, one of which resulted in the park being closed in, I believe, 1991.
That's right.
And it turned out that they used that excuse to completely reconfigure the park.
Okay, so once again, they came in unilaterally. The police and the Parks Department came in unilaterally in violation of the city charter without any approval from the community board and actually sealed off the park, erected chicken wire fences around the whole thing, and for almost a year, the park was completely...
Actually, more like a year and a half.
Yeah.
And the thing is that they used this riot that they instigated to close the park and at the same time destroy the band shell, considering it the focal point of anger and skirmishes with the police.
They used a lot of things. They also used the creating an untenable situation of people's good intent to support the right of homeless people to live in the park. For example, you know, there were 100 people in the park. A homeless person would be walking into the park and say, well, how did you find out about Tompkins Square? Well, they told me down on the Lower West Side that I could go to Tompkins Square Park. The Parks Department started sending people Tompkins Square Park.
This is after the 88 riot.
Right. That's what I'm saying. They created an untenable situation so that when you know, people were finding the occasional needle here, needle there, it became hyped up. The New York Post could say, thugs take over Tompkins Square Park. There were 300 people living in there.
That was one strategy to get the park, to get acceptance to close the park and reconfigure it and change the demographics.
It was difficult.
What I was getting at a second ago, there was what we discovered by a little fact-checking and digging in city records ourselves was that contracts to rebuild the park and reconfigure everything and destroy the bench hall had been signed many months before that skirmish with the police in 1991. Mm-hmm. So they had to instigate something with the people in the neighborhood in order to have their justification. And like Frank said, there was definitely a concerted effort after the 88 riot to, and maybe it took them a couple of years to get it into place, but they ultimately succeeded in changing the use pattern of the park and the demographics in the neighborhood after the park reopened in, I think, the end of 92 or the summer of 93. Then more yuppie businesses, and they were interviewed in the newspapers saying so, felt safe. The neighborhood was investor-friendly, investor-safe, and suddenly a million yuppie dives and bars started opening up.
Paving the way for the ultra-development blitz, which we witnessed today.
Which we're experiencing today, yes. This is the latest wave of hyperinflation and hyper-gentrification. And those who survived the first wave in the 80s somehow made it to the present. They're finding it very hard to survive right now. And so there's a lot of anger and tension in the neighborhood at this point, basically due to the same factors.
Marisol Ruiz, will you share with us some recollections? Where were you on August 6, 1988?
I was just a witness to the whole thing. I really wasn't an active member of the riots, so I don't really have much to say.
No, I was pretty much just a witness, too, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, we're all witnesses.
We're all witnesses, but you have to, sometimes verbally you can respond when you see an old lady, homeless woman, trying to go into the park to go to sleep. And has nothing to do with anything, getting beaten down by the police.
So why don't you tell us some of what you witnessed?
Among other things. Oh, come on, you're among friends here. It's okay. Well, I could tell you, Bill, what I witnessed, some things, if it's appropriate.
Sure.
Among other things, basically we spent the whole night running away from the police. They were like charging us in waves. And then we would charge back toward them when they receded, when their wave receded back to the park. It was the game of cat and mouse. It was back and forth, waves coming at us and us coming back at them. I mean, we, you know, the people in the neighborhood basically gave as good as we got. Some people went further than others, and they threw things at the police because the police had been beating people up. I mean, one school of thought is, you know, if the police didn't ratchet up the violence, then people would not have responded in a violent manner. I chose to basically just document what I was experiencing, but I was seeing really horrible things. For example, a waitress working in the 7A Cafe, I don't know if she was a manager of the restaurant or a waitress there. It's like a sidewalk cafe at the corner of 7th Street and Avenue A on the southwest corner, which is still there today. And the police ran in there, just grabbed her by the hair, pulled her out by the hair. Now, I remember now, they beat up a waitress, they pulled her out by the hair, and then the manager of the restaurant, a female, was objecting to this because they were working there. They weren't outside confronting the police. And they beat the manager badly, too. They beat them both up. An Asian man coming out of his apartment to go out for the night, they stomped on him. He was coming down the stairs of his building. He's obviously not part of any demonstration. They broke. He lost a finger. As I say, I saw an old homeless woman trying to get into the park to go to sleep because it was a kind of tacit agreement with the police at that point, with the homeless and the police, where after midnight they could just go into the park, quietly find a corner, sleep, get out by dawn, and that had been honored up until that night, I guess. They beat her really badly. As I say, a lot of neighbors getting beaten up. It was a really violent, violent night, and at one point, one cop.
All right, it went on all night. It went on to dawn, till dawn.
Well,
the police brought out a helicopter.
Here's where it gets tricky.
There were battles raging up and down Avenue A all to the wee hours.
Yes, one of the funniest moments, as I recall, are despite the fact that police were arriving from all over the city with no chain of command and no CO, commanding officer, to coordinate them or control them, no one for them to answer to, they had put out a 1013, which is their parlance for officer down. So police from all over the city, all five boroughs, descended on the park. Despite that, at one point, somehow somebody had got the police to line up in some sort of a formation. And they're all wearing their hats. They're all lined up on Avenue A. Then the police helicopter descends right above their heads, and all of their hats go flying off their heads. And in a scene reminiscent of a Keystone Cops movie, the cops are running like crazy, scattered, trying to get their hats, and the whole formation is broke down, and everyone's just laughing hysterically at them, and that kind of like got them pissed off further. And to answer your question, yes, it went all night till 6 in the morning. Now, the police had decided that the curfew would begin at 12 midnight and end at 6 in the morning, which is where it's at today. So on the police side, they could...
I thought that originally it was 1 o'clock that they were going to impose the curfew. That's, I have a pretty clear recollection of
that. Could be that.
Subsequently...
But, I mean, of course, when they finally actually did, several years later, or 5 years later... No, 3 years later. 3 years later, 88 to 91, when they finally did impose the curfew, then it was a midnight curfew.
Right.
It remains one today.
Well,
but I think originally they were trying to enforce a 1 a.m. curfew.
Everything blew up at midnight. The cops just waited. They were like timing it. Everyone's timing it. Everyone's just watching their clocks. As soon as it was midnight, the cops started wailing on everybody. That's exactly what I remember. But what I'm getting back to is at 6 in the morning, the police slowly withdrew. And we stood them down all night, and then people ran back into Tompkins Square Park. Now, on our side, we would say we won because we made the cops leave. On the police point of view is they held the park closed till 6 a.m., so they won. So it's like the silly little gang versus gang kind of a thing. But in
well,
our case,
they weren't getting paid anymore at that point. So they
well, that's another good point. But we're not the gang. We lived there. That's the difference. They were an invading army, and we were, indigenous people defending our territory, like the Vietnamese, you know, fighting against the American troops coming in, you know. It was kind of akin to that. And I could tell you what happened after people retook Tompkins Square Park, if you'd like.
Sure, Chris.
Not that I agreed with it, but this is what I witnessed. Several people ran to the Christadora House, which was built originally in 1897 as a settlement house for the poor in the neighborhood to help them get housing, medical care, schooling, essential needs to assimilate in this new country. And over the course of years, after I say sometime between the 60s and 80s, it became an abandoned building. From the early 80s to the late 80s, it had been flipped by real estate speculators several times until finally around 1987, being renovated into a huge, very wealthy luxury condominium complex for very wealthy people. As a result, it became the focal point of the anger and the rage toward the gentrification of our neighborhood. So, not that I agreed with it, but this is what happened. People, after taking back Tompkins Square Park, some people just spontaneously announced that they should take the Christadora. They invaded the lobby of the Christadora building. The lobby man just ran for his life. People inside the lobby really didn't go any further than that, but someone took the potted plant out of the lobby and threw it on the street of Avenue B and smashed it. Almost immediately, the cry went out, "Save the tree! Save the tree!" In the middle of all this anger, this call went out to save the tree. The tree was picked up and replanted in Tompkins Square Park. Kind of poetic justice, you know. And I believe it was, I don't know if it's still there today. It may very well be, but that's my memory of what I saw there that night. It was exhilarating. It was like a second childhood, but it was also very scary. At some points, I almost got really badly hurt. I spent the whole night running. I never ran so much in my life to save my life. I almost got hit by this one cop. He swung his club so hard. He was so sure that club was going to connect with my head. And I ducked back, and I heard a whoosh, and he fell down. He was so sure that that club was going to hit my head. He put all he had into it, and when it didn't connect, he fell on the floor, and I just ran for my life. But, you know, I would say a lot of neighbors were behind us because at the corner of 4th Street and Avenue A, where the police were blinded by the streetlights, above the streetlights, this apartment complex on 4th and A had tenants throwing bottles at the cops.
Yeah, it's when people started reacting from the windows.
It went way beyond street activists.
They put snipers up on the roofs along A and St. Mark's.
That same night, August 6th.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the helicopter came in, hovering right over St. Mark's and A. Like, it couldn't have been more than, 30, 40 feet above the building. I mean, it came way down.
Actually, it came a little lower than building lines.
It was whipping up. It was like a sandstorm, you know, amidst all this
and for what? Just a theatrical prop to intimidate and people would just, all it did was fuel the anger and the rage.
Well, that's the thing. That's the part of the dynamic of violence is that it's cyclical. So, you know, in terms of one way of looking at it, is everybody they started beating up, it brought more people to the cause.
Actually, Frank is right, because now my recollection is further that...
People were pouring out of the bars going, oh, look at this, you know.
If we started with a hypothetical, let's say 100 people demonstrating against the police at night, it grew to hundreds of people because, like Frank said, people coming out of their apartments, yeah. they were appalled. It wasn't just squatter, homeless, right. anarchist, hippie, you know, a punker
well, forced,
against the police. It was neighbors
forced
against
to make
police.
A moral choice. If you're standing there while coming out of a bar and some girl is getting beat up by these two kind of robocops, you know, people reacted.
And cops had
their
badges covered that night, too.
I remember at one point...
the ones that weren't in plain clothes.
This whole phalanx of cops come around 9th Street between A and 1st, and we're shooting... I think it's 9th Street, and we're shooting... Maybe it's St. Mark's. We're shooting down the street, just like, you know, 50 people in this one group. And this a couple of horses, cops behind us, and they're flailing and the whole thing. And we run into this bar, and we shut the door behind us. The bar is full of people.
Was that the international bar?
I don't remember. We shut the door.
I hid inside
right?
the bar, the international.
And the cops come to the window, to the grate, and start beating on the window.
That was the international.
Right us,
that was insane.
Right?
I remember that.
We're looking right at them.
And they were like mad dogs. They were like mad pit bulls.
But on the inside, the sense of solidarity, I mean, I don't need to explain what that would feel like, right? You're all protecting each other from this madness. And that's what it was this kind of pathology. It was what the police, you know, it's like wilding, cops wilding.
That's a good description, exactly.
You know, they were sort of on this kill mission. They had their badges taped over. Like
the ones that were in uniforms. Others were plain clothes, and they were just coming like yeah. rampaging gangs. So you didn't even yeah. know they were cops until they started hitting you. And they were arriving. I mean, cops were just coming from all over the city, unaccountable to any commanding officer. In fact, the fact that they didn't arrest anybody, they just beat the crap out of people. I mean,
well, when they did, though.
Right, now, wait, what do you mean unaccountable to any commanding officer? I mean, when Manhattan South Task Force would have been in command.
Well,
right?
You know, what didn't Captain McNamara say he had to go to use the toilet and do number
yeah.
two? Because I can't curse on the radio. He did number two at a precinct like 2 miles away.
He was the commander of the 9th Precinct at that time.
Yeah.
Right.
So
yeah.
So this is his excuse for not being present
in
when
their,
his men were going nuts. You
in
know?
There, I have it here. In there, their August 23rd, 1988. From the chief of department, police commissioner, Tompkins Square Park incident report.
You got everything, Frankie.
they talk about that there was no part of the problem is there was no centralized control. That's what that, now this is their rap
analysis
there,
after
there was
the
no,
fact.
Nobody was in command.
Mm-hmm.
It's common knowledge that the
okay,
person
now, this you're citing what document here?
Police department, City of New York, chief of department. Police Commissioner Tompkins Square Park incident
mm-hmm.
in capital letters,
mm-hmm.
August 23rd, 1988.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a 30-page report from the police department. You know, and what it basically the guy who was supposedly in charge took a walk.
He claimed he had to use the toilet, and he couldn't use the precinct toilet. He had to go a few miles away to some
kind of
other
deniability.
Precinct.
So you know, they didn't have anybody there. So then the notion was that they were functioning in disparate little ganglets,
mm-hmm.
and they could just go around and beat people up. But clearly, they had a staging area on 14th Street off of Avenue D over there, which is generally where they staged before they moved. Because we dealt with them in buildings. They try to throw us out of building. You know, they have a logistics that they carry out.
It should also be pointed out that they were beating up witnesses to what they were doing. Any people with cameras, a lot of people that I knew with cameras were getting especially targeted. They targeted Clayton Patterson, I met a friend David Sorch, they smashed his camera. Paul Gammon, our mutual friend Paul Gammon, was on top of a van filming them, charging the crowd, you know, like beating people, and two cops spotted him, Officer Vecchi and Skrizpek. These are their real names. And they both had covered badges because now when our friend Peter was a photographer.
Right, how did we determine
he
their
took
names
a photo.
If they have covered badges?
That's right.
Well, that's the amazing thing. Our friend Peter took a photo of... Well, here's what happened. They saw Paul on the van. They started beating up. He was filming himself getting beaten up by the police. They beat him up, pulled him off the van, smashed his camera, smashed him. Somehow the video survived. Peter took a photograph of them beating him, and they're standing over him. Somehow the police department, in some rare act of vigilance in their own way, found out who these two cops were. They went on trial. I was present at the trial, of course. The judge, I swear to God, the judge was there with his head in his hand, his eyes closed like he was sleeping. When it was all over, the judge says, oh, not guilty, not guilty. He wakes up. That was the end of it. It was a farce. But they were both found not guilty. But the absurd thing was Paul Guerin filming himself getting beaten up by the police. The most insane thing. And I've seen the video. And he's screaming, I'm getting down, I'm getting down. And they just kept on whacking at him. And the camera just goes, psh, and he's dead.
So in terms of the equation of the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, Yeah, this sense of exhilaration that when the sun was coming up, going back into the park, people feeling, and you know, there's, and you know, it's not a question of popularizing, you know, violence, or that certain tactics, but the notion, the experience of standing up to this kind of police brutality and mass, like the
it was community solidarity, definitely.
Community self-defense, whatever, right. Is empowering. So there's that. But on the other side, there were literally hundreds of people went to the hospital. 300 people filed complaints, and you know, that's
which
only
went nowhere.
A third
nothing
or a quarter.
Okay, but some people did get big settlements eventually.
Oh, a number of people.
Everybody
did.
That got hit and got really injured got at least 50,000. I mean, is it 50,000 apiece? I know Dave Reagan Youth got.
Were a lot of people that were
double digit amazing. Settlements. The city did not want to deal with.
Do you know how many people got double digit settlements?
I
would say a few dozen people that I know personally got that kind of settlement
in that neighborhood.
If you had something like a camera smashed in addition to your getting bodily hurt, then you got more money. But there was really an effort to stop people from documenting and witnessing.
Because even the mainstream media, for the most part, in the days immediately following, were critical of the police. It was hard not to, because there were a lot of people witnessing. There were a lot of there's a lot of footage. You know, you didn't have the total monolithic grip on the newsprint that seems to be, you know, the current situation today. There were some you know, truthful reporting that went on in terms of what happened that night.
Well, Frank, you bring up a very important point, because initially the media correctly saw us as the victims of police out of control. But then a funny thing started happening in the days after the riot. The spin started turning against us. Suddenly the media was calling us the instigators. Benjamin Ward, the then police commissioner, said we were all kids from Scarsdale, white kids from Scarsdale. These are his words. And the media started attacking us as provoking these poor innocent cops who were helpless and couldn't defend themselves against us insane hordes of people. So it was the result of the distorted media coverage stemming from the 88 riot, which actually led to the creation of The Shadow.
Right.
Because we felt it was time to resurrect the underground press on the Lower East Side
when did
the 60s and 70s.
When did the first issue of The Shadow come out?
March of 1989, a few months after the 88 riot. And by that time, we had investigated enough about the 88 riot to come out with our riot issue.
And might I mention that it was entirely typewritten. You actually used a typewriter.
Well, there weren't really PCs available at the time. There's no Adobe Photoshop. It was an IBM typewriter. You cut little pieces of paper out of the Xerox, and you'd use rubber cement to paste it down. We still use rubber cement, actually. We still do it the old-fashioned way. But at least we have WordPerfect, and we have, you know, a couple of modern conveniences, you know, scanners and the internet. But back then, you really didn't have the internet as it exists today.
No, you didn't have the internet at all.
You didn't have the PC revolution where pieces were very cheap and common. Yeah, so it was very low tech.
But people did have word processors, but you were using a typewriter.
It was a very low tech operation, but it got the job done. It was a nice homegrown, handmade
very
product.
Very homegrown, very handmade.
It did its job.
Elevated morally and sort of backward technologically.
But we had to create, we had to resurrect the underground press with help from people like Frank, you know, yourself, you know, investigative journalists from the neighborhood, politically active photographers, writers, artists, and thank goodness this huge pool of talent that was also politically right on and aware and active was available to come together for this project. And it's eerie to think by March it'll be 20 years we've been doing The Shadow. Like,
okay, and you're about to put out a new issue.
Yes, thank you. What a good segue, Bill.
for your first new issue in how many months now? You've kind of slowed down a little bit.
In those earlier years, a lot more was happening than but practically every other weekend was a major skirmish or event or
Shadow's
new revelation.
Shadow's a shadow of its former self.
Well, we had more time. We were younger. We were younger. There was more stuff going on. We had more time to spare.
All right, so when was the last issue?
You know,
just
people's lives
curiosity.
Change. You don't have the same time you used to have. The very last issue came out September, October of last year. So whereas we used to come out once a month, now it's once every 4 to 6 months.
Yeah, okay.
That's not so bad, you know.
All right, so anyway, hopefully you're actually going to have it in print by the concert on Sunday.
By the time of the concert. And by the way, I should mention something also about the concert. This is not a celebration of any violence toward the police or celebrating any form of violence in the neighborhood. It's a commemoration of what happened on July 31st of 1988 and August 6th of 1988. It's a commemoration, which is a remembrance, in the hope that such a thing never happens again. There are many cops that were around those days who have actually kind of have a grudging respect for a lot of us now, because we're kind of like veterans of, like, practically like the Civil War veterans, where, you know, when, by the time they were in their 80s and 90s and they had these reunions, you know, they were no longer hostile toward each other. What you have now, I think, is a situation where the police really, it's not in their interest to have another riot, and it's not our desire or our interest to have another riot or to encourage a riot or any violence of any kind. So in the old days, we used to say, after the 88 riot, the simple equation, no cops equals no riot. I think the police have learned that if they don't want anything to happen, they kind of lay back and they don't provoke a riot. In those days, they were provoking purposely riots and skirmishes. I think the police have learned now to, you know, more diplomatically deal with us, and we have done the same with them. I don't think we've had any problems with the police in well over a decade. I don't think there's been any major problem, and we want to keep it that way. The purpose of these commemorative concerts, July 27, August 2nd, and August 3rd in Tompkins Square Park, is to let us never forget what happened. Let's revisit the causes of why it happened and compare it to what's going on today. We have the same factors, but unfortunately magnified by a factor of at least 100. It's really bad. Rents are much higher than they were 20
years
ago. Well,
yes, because, I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, I mean, we were defeated back in 1991.
Well, you see, it depends on your point of view.
I mean, not entirely, because a lot of us survived, right? And a lot of the squats have since become legal, you know, homeowners and
so
on.
There you go. It depends on how you define defeated. Do we have access to zillions of dollars to buy entire buildings and kick people out and build luxury condos and change the demographics of a neighborhood? No, that happened. Because it was on its way to happening anyway. Did we slow down the forces of gentrification for a few years after the 88 riot? Yes, and I'm proud of that. I think we did a damn good job. You can't keep up the heat forever. So by 91, 92, you know, they started making their inroads. The economy started going back up again, because by 88, 89, we had a mild recession. And I think we're heading for a major, major economic recession, catastrophe. And I think that will result in a lot of the yuppies and people who pay too much for their real estate losing their apartments, losing their buildings.
All right.
And it's a way of kind of like balancing things out again.
Should we consider throwing open the phone lines?
Hell yes.
If there's any veterans of the Tompkins Square riot.
I'm looking at a list
there.
Of seven words I can't say on this radio. It's all of George Carlin's routine, the seven dirty words you can't say in the air. It's the exact seven words. I don't dare say them because I don't want you to get in trouble.
Thank you.
But you can say the word hell at least. Thank goodness for that. I mean, I was told that after midnight, you're allowed to say certain words on the air.
Well, we did give a we in fact did use a couple of those words, and I did give a warning at the beginning. So we're
but after midnight, aren't you allowed to use?
No, technically you're not.
I heard
but
you were.
But it's a little bit of a gray area, because we talk about community standards.
And if you gave a warning ahead of time, a disclaimer?
Right, yes.
So can I say those seven words?
No.
Okay, well.
All right, but why don't we see if there's anybody out there who...
I hate censorship, it's ridiculous.
Who remembers the Tompkins Square riot and wants to call in and share some memories with us. We'll take your calls right after we hear a little bit more of Missing Foundation. And
hunting we will go.
The number, by the way, if you've never called before, and we encourage you people who've never called before to give us a call, is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. One more time. That's 212. What did I say?
209-2900.
Is that what I said? I think that's what I said, right?
I think it's what
okay, let's hear some more of the Missing Foundation.
What's the code for the bathroom?
No. Oh, God. This is the one. There we go. Okay. Hello? There we go. soothing new age sounds of Missing Foundation. Frank, you tell us something about your memories of Missing Foundation.
Well, Pete has a way with words,
so to speak.
He's very articulate in terms of the nature of evil, and he put his words across with a bullhorn. That's what you get that sound. And his band, Missing Foundation, which has guitar players, bass players, but the really powerful thing about them was also the large, you know, where you burn wood,
bonfire?
Drums. Yeah.
But like, you know, like metal drums.
Metal drums, really big ones. This is before Stomp and all the rest of that stuff. And they'd have like eight of them up on the stage, and with two or three people per drum, and they were mostly neighborhood kids. A lot of Puerto Rican kids and black kids from the neighborhood and so on. They'd all have Missing Foundation t-shirts, like black t-shirts with thing in there.
With the Missing Foundation logo, which was a representation of an upside-down champagne glass with the contents falling out.
And they would be fire. There'd be wood in them and fire coming out. So this is all going
on. Meaning the party's over, right?
That was with the
champagne logo.
So what you're hearing is coming at you with this fire, and Pete would be kind of just stationary in the center of the stage with the bullhorn prophesying, you know, I mean, it's water wars or the white culture is dead, 1988 is 1933.
It's a perfect expression of the anger and rage.
We won't act civilized. Effing city.
Right.
And total war for living space.
One time there was a show, in fact it was during this period, and it evoked a kind of feeling of paranoia and panic. It was exhilarating in terms of its kind of revolutionary message, but on the other hand, viscerally, it was, you know. And I'm sitting in the bench across from the band shell with Ginsberg one night. It was maybe one in the morning, and they were like doing their thing, and there was like a couple of hundred people there. The fires are burning, the cans are being kicked over, and general kind of revolutionary. Let's take it now feeling. And Alan says, it's very powerful, but it's very violent. And he was very, you know, he was very concerned about that it was evoking this feeling. And, no major punchline here. I had to agree with him because that's the thing. When you're in a riot and by its nature, it's kind of the dialectic of you know, violence and love and, you know, injustice and injustice and all that kind of stuff, you know. And Alan was very articulate about what he was feeling at that point, you know. But he'd always come to our shows and stuff and do different things.
He performed quite often on Tom Kassir's shows we had after the riot.
Oh, yeah. He and Drucker used to do a great version of CIA Calypso, you know. And
Ballad of the Skeletons. Yeah. Great, great original poetry that he just made up. And
you want to hear first. You want to hear my Tompkins Square riot story, which actually concerns Allen Ginsberg.
There you go.
It's very prosaic, actually. But I was getting, you remember there was this restaurant called the Kiev, Ukrainian restaurant on 2nd Avenue called the Kiev?
Yeah.
Well, before the riot, I was in there eating some pierogi, and in walks Allen Ginsberg with this young, fresh-faced farm kid who's obviously in awe of him, and they happen to sit down at the table right next to me, and they're talking about how they're going to go over to Tompkins Square and check out the action after dinner, which is exactly what I was going to do, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, this kid looks like he just got off the bus from Kansas. And then in the next day's paper, I read that among the people who were arrested was a young house guest of Allen Ginsberg's from Kansas.
Oh, jeez. How funny.
I kid you not. Anyway, Mary Saul, you were just saying how much you miss the bad old days of urban blight.
Well, my memories of the Lower East Side, it's very different from what we see today. Back then, there were always events, political meetings, poetry readings all over the place, all times of the day. There was an energy in the air that I don't see today. what the kind of energy that I see today in the Lower East Side or East Village is Yuppieland. It's something different. I don't even recognize the place. I feel like I'm in another country, like I need a passport to get in there. So
you should try living in it under occupation.
It was very different. Very, very different. That's all I can say for now.
Mm-hmm. So you were squatting on the Lower East Side back in the day, back in the 80s.
Yes, I did. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So should we see if anybody out there wants to contribute to this?
Yes, yes. Somebody call.
Once again, the number is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. If you were there, if you were at Tompkins Square Park on the night of August 6th, 1988, give us a call and share your memories with us. 212-209-2900. You're on the air. Turn down the radio. Right, I should say, first of all, the first thing is turn down the radio. As soon as you hear the phone pick up, turn down the radio.
It's down. It's way down. And I live on the Lower East Side, and no, I was not at the riot. Sorry, but I have some things to say. Number one, I live in Serenity House, and I've lived in Pest. And
okay, what is Serenity House?
Serenity House was a squat on the Lower East Side and East 9th Street, and
still is a squat.
No, we are in.
Oh, right, that's true. That's true. You're legalized.
We are in REM, and yes. All the buildings are in REM from going from being squat to going legal.
Right, this is true. Yeah.
Mm. In differing, varying conditions of going in REM of going legal. And what happened was, in 1988, I was going to college in New Jersey, and I came over here for it. I heard there was going to be a rally, and I bumped into a friend who had a stick of tea, and we imbibed, and I got rather high, and I didn't know anybody here at that time.
A stick of tea.
So, reefer, muggles.
Right. We're talking to an old beatnik from the past here.
Oh, kind of. I want to be. Old hippie. And I left and went back, and then I heard on BAI, like, oh, no. Oh, my goodness. So, look, you know, we always said on the Lower East Side that the pigs started the riot. We never provoked the pigs at any time. Even in 1991, I agree, the cops sort of fooled us into causing the riot, the Memorial Day riot in 1991. We fell for it, and it's why we don't commemorate them for the 1991 Memorial Day riot.
Right. Well, you know, what happened on August 6, 1988 was, it's most correctly called a police riot, because it was the police were really running rampage. I have to, to put it out on the record, I, object to calling, using the terminology of pigs, because it's dehumanizing propaganda, and we should be above that. But let's see if there's anybody else out there who remembers the Tompkins Square riot of August 6th, 1988. WBAI, you're on the air. No, you're not. I wonder why that happens. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Hi. How you doing tonight?
Okay.
Got a great show.
Turn down the radio, please.
I sure did.
Yeah.
Hey, I do remember that. I was living down in the East Village right across from the Veselka. It was disgusting. It was a disgusting thing and disturbing thing to have to see. I do remember that. I did want to ask you guys, though. Your show is really great tonight. It's a lot of fun. But do you know what the government's not telling you about George Carlin dying this year?
What's that?
Is that it's an election year, and he didn't believe in Jesus.
And?
It was a joke.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Right. Gotcha.
All right. Have a good one, guys.
Take care, man.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, do we want to keep going with phone calls? Or
Yeah, come on. Yeah.
All right, well, somebody's got to call in. 212-209-2900.
If you're listening, call in. It's like a unique opportunity to share a common experience and or your perspective on, let's say you were too young to have been present or you heard everything about it and you want to know more about it. This is a good time to find out more about it.
See, that's really who I would like to hear from as well. Not only, oldsters who were there that night, but youngsters who, if you're listening and you're in your 20s, supposing that there is anybody who listens to WBAI who's in their 20s, I'm, you know, how much of this history are you aware of? Do you know that there was a Tompkins Square riot? Do you know that there was a Tompkins Square bandshell? Do you know that there is a Tompkins Square? WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? Hello? Mm-hmm. You're on the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I grew up on the Lower East Side, came down here in the 70s, and I wasn't there actually at the riot, but I lived down near by the Alfred E. Smith houses, and we used to go over to Tompkins Square Park and sit and talk and laugh. They also had manpower that had a lot of people working to renovate buildings around there. And
right, now, what era are we talking now? We're talking about the
80s? 80s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The 80s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a horrible situation. By that time, I was in my early 20s. When we heard about it, we cried. I mean, literally, I'm an African-American. And we used to go and sit with the multicultural groups down on the Lower East Side, and we shared a relationship. When we found out a lot of people were homeless in the area, we had compassion for them. At that time, you also had Jesse Jackson doing marches for the homeless. And we were trying to figure out what was the economic problem that was going on in that area. But it was a sham. It was horrible to find out that, you know, the police came in and just for a park. We didn't know about gentrification at the time. I just thought that they were abusing the homeless because they were trying to mess up the park. But it turned out that there was another bigger picture going on, and it was cruel and indecent, and we were emotionally upset. And I've just recently been reading a book by Walter Mosley about the L.A. riots, and to just wake up by a friend who's a photographer who's talking about doing, you know, some background information on New York City, to hear and turn on a great program, WBAI, this early in the morning, it just takes me back to see what's going on now, precedes what happened a long time ago. And it's never going to leave the minds of people. I think people need to open up and see where all this came from, why we're having such a hard homeless problem today in New York, and why the mortgage and all these different housing problems are existing, and why we are not so friendly with the police department, in which we should be, because they're supposed to be here to help the people that they are getting paid from, the citizens of New York. New York is a wonderful city. It's been a multicultural city for years. And I think that the young lady that said the picture of it has changed, she's absolutely right. When I was coming up, I don't care what race, creed, or color you were in New York, what age, when something went down, we came out. We came out in floods. We fought against all kind of issues. We stood on the battlefield. We thanked the ancestors and the senior citizens for paving the way for us. And now there's this sense of, how can I say it? There's a sense of it's not important to go out there and beat the pavement and go to the marches. Like, there are particular things people will come out for, and there are some things that they want, but they won't go out to fight for it. They want other people to do it. And it's affecting thousands of people, and you can get 50, 100, will do all the major work while other people sit back and reap the benefits.
Do you think the factors are in place to actually to see something like an 1988 uprising take place again? Do you think those things could cause that to happen again today?
I'm going to tell you what I believe, because I'm going to tell you I'm a child of God. And I believe I walk in love, and I don't walk in fear. I believe in peace, and I don't believe in violence. But there's a time where you can push people to a certain point where it's pressure like a teapot. The pressure goes on, and then you don't turn it down, and then poof, you know, all the air comes bursting out. And I have taught young people that the pen is mightier than the sword. That you don't always, I come from the Martin Luther King generation. I don't believe you always have to fight and beat up and have violence to make things change. I believe that change can happen in the hearts of each and any individual, and that the leaders that you put in place, people that you put there to help you make a difference, they sit back and they wait for the pressure to come on, and then they wait for it to boom so that they can come out and say, you know, this is what's going on. We already know what's going on. We don't need any more talk shows. We got radio stations that are not being listened to, that's not being supported, that give relevant and updated information from the past to the present.
Like WBAI, I assume you mean.
I mean, yes, of course, WBAI
yes.
is precious.
Well, on that subject,
so
I should mention that next week on this show, we're going to be asking listeners for their money. So if you are not a member of WBAI, all you people out there, this will be your opportunity to become a member of WBAI.
Right,
yes.
Right. And what happened is this. We who listen to WBAI, who are not employed,
right.
Who was employed,
yeah.
Who have supported WBAI, I tell other people, you got money,
step up to the plate.
You need to put your money where your mouth is.
Yes, indeed.
You got people that have been listening to stations, getting all the GOAT information, going out there, being blessed, changing lives, and yet, the minute you ask somebody for a dime, it's like, oh no, I can't do that. No, you have to do it. It's mandated that you support programs, initiatives that make a difference in the lives of not just you and your family, but the nation at large. Television, R.L. Morrow, the great journalist for Channel 13, will roll over in his grave 10 times the way they're showing the media information today. It's a disgrace.
Amen. Amen.
So unless people say, okay, I'm not going to turn the TV on today. I'm not going to just listen to the rock and roll music. I'm going to turn on some valid information that can take me from being in la-la land to being updated to what's really realistic and relevant today to get them from A to B. Because, see, I come from a bumpy generation where we stayed at the party too long. There's a lot of selfishness going on today. Where our ancestors, our parents paved the way. We were supposed to pass the torch. We were busy at the parties, being cute, getting high, doing all the stuff. Now we're in church, right? We say we love the Lord. We say whether you're Catholic or religious, whether you're not religious, but you say you have a lot of love, but where are you passing that off to the next generation? How come when I was this age, 19, 20, we were marching to Washington, fighting for CUNY and SUNY, and my babies are sitting around waiting for things to happen because I've been with young people for 30 years.
Thank you very much. We got to move on. We got a lot of other calls, but thank you very much for your call.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Take care. Likewise. Thanks for sharing.
Chris, did you want to? We got still 5 minutes. Let's before we announce it again, let's take advantage of the fact that there are people calling in. You'll get your opportunity at the end to announce it. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah.
Was this the situation where the helicopters were in...
Yep.
Yeah, did you mention that?
Yep, we mentioned it.
More than once, thank you.
And the band shell is like the one in Central Park, and in the old days, people didn't, you know, have to go up to Central Park because they had a beautiful park.
That's right.
In Tompkins Square Park. And then what happened was the homeless went into the kind of where they had rhododendron bushes and other bushes, and they made their little encampments, and then they would burn the wood to keep warm in the winter.
That's right.
And then
we already told the whole story, Monroe. You don't have to reiterate it. Dilly Bay, you're on the air.
Die hard, yabby scum.
Gee, who could this be?
A couple of points. One was, you know, what got left out in all of this was the heroic effort of a number of politicized homeless people who fought, like, monumental battles with the police, with the city, and Tompkins Square Park over a long period of time. that kind of got just erased out of that whole equation.
You know? Okay, well, fill in the gaps, please.
Well, you know, Tent City, who came out of the 80s 3rd Street Men's Shelter, formed one section of the park where they were very political. I mean, they marched from here to Washington with the Homeless March on Washington, fought like battles with the police when there was even nobody over there except for them in the, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. And that, it was just amazing. And that all got kind of turned into, oh, it was a crack infested swamp over there. And the other one factor that, you know, everybody has to consider is the heroin business in the neighborhood. I mean, that's been something that has been affecting all of us for as long as we've been down here. And it's still there, you know, one or two or three or more ODs a week over in Tompkins Square Park. I mean, that's been a kind of, I mean, that dominated the neighborhood back during those days. And you have to wonder, you know, was there some kind of a plan behind this, you know? But that's something.
All right. So why do you say die hard, yuppie scum?
Oh, because we've been protesting over at Bruce Willis's Bowery Wine Company on the Bowery, and we just kind of pushed it as a parody of Bruce Willis, but. You know, I don't.
So the old slogan from the 80s was "Die, yuppie scum."
That's right. Mm. But what I wanted to say was, I don't know if Chris announced it, but some friends of David Peel are throwing a birthday party for him on August 3rd, and that's going to be at 8 p.m. at the Christadora House. So
where is the Christadora House again, John?
It's on Avenue B and 9th Street, but that'll be after the other a couple hours after the concert in the park ends. There's going to be a birthday celebration for David Peel, and people might not know it, but we've started somewhat of another confrontation with Christadora House, and it's going to get even more heated at this birthday party. So everybody should come down and check this action out, you know, both days, actually, but definitely come to David's party and bring some cake and donuts and food and stuff.
Is it true Bruce Willis is donating pizza pies?
Yeah, I think I'm going to get 10 pizzas out of the Bowery Wine Company. I mean, my motto is...
It's starting to sound like a protection racket.
Oh, yes, I'm the Al Sharpton of food, man.
Oh, jeez.
Listen, if you want to get rid of us, you can bribe us with food and we'll go away, because we're getting ready for that time in the near future when we're going to probably have to do this in order to eat. And so we're getting some training in shaking down restaurants for food. I'm not kidding about that. You think you're laughing, but I'm totally serious. And on top of it, I'm shaking down reporters for food. I've already gotten two meals out of the New York Post in the last week. So,
All right. Okay. Well, we need to get off the air because it's almost quitting time here on the Marshall Orthodox Radio Crusade. So, Chris, why don't you tell us one more time about 1980s Nostalgia Night in Tompkins Square Park this weekend?
Okay. This weekend, we've got, well, actually, there's three shows commemorating the 20th anniversary of the Tompkins Square Park riots. Shadow's hosting a show on July, all in Tompkins Square Park on 7th Street and Avenue A at the site of the old band shell. And basically, all of these shows are celebrating the vitality of the countercultural scene that basically survived in the Lower East Side despite the gentrification, the soaring rents, the lost venues, and the yuppie invasion that have contributed to the cultural genocide sweeping New York City. So on July 27th, all these shows are from 1 to 7 p.m. The Shadow is hosting a show featuring 80s punk bands, Hammer Brain, Reagan Youth, Nihilistics, False Prophets, Apple, David Peel, Kraut, and Professor Louie. The other two shows on the following weekend are August 2nd and August 3rd, also commemorating the 20th anniversary of the Tompkins Square police riot, and also 1 to 7 p.m. There are more shows scheduled in the park after. We have a lot of shows, and our friends of ours do as well. September 27th.
Well, we'll have the opportunity to announce that again.
Let me just say real quick, if you want more information, you can go to our website.
There you go.
http://shadowpress.org. Or you can go to
http://shadowpress.org.
If you head to shadowpress.org, you'll get it.
That's right.
Shadowpress.org, and you also can try TSP as in Tompkins Square Park, tsplive.org. And we're also mounting a campaign to rebuild the Tompkins Square Park band shell. We'll have petitions present, and we're hoping that everyone's going to sign petitions. For what it's worth, you know, we're anarchists. We don't believe that the system really works for us. But we also believe that when you put enough pressure on local politicians, you can get what you want.
Okay. And with that, it is 1:30 in the a.m. This has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM. Please support us in our mini-emergency.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.